Hey, hello. Hello. That felt like a very northern introduction to a podcast. Hello. How are you? How goes it, sir?
If anybody in the South is listening, or any other part of the world, that's hello. Good afternoon, good morning. How is life? All rolled up into one. But yeah, things are good. Things are good. It's spring. Still raining heavily in the UK. Spring has sprung us. But yeah, no, it's good. It's good. Had good weekend with the family and everything else, and heavily delving into, I'm just picking up some stuff, lots of books at the minute. Lots of books, Ben. I know that we've been looking at lots of books. Went through, and I'm just delving back into EdTech to PedTech. As well, so
Fiona, that's one thing.
Just picking that one back up, as well as lots of AI books.
Yes,
and one that we'll discuss today, as you can imagine. Still not read Dan's, but I'll get round to it at some point.
it's because he didn't send you a free copy. He didn't send me one either. Yeah, you'd have thought we've been mates for a long time. You're a tight Yorkshireman. He's a tight Geordie. No, I'm just. I've read it, Dan. We still love you, mate. It's been good. It feels a little bit like we get into that season. I feel like I need to tell you this as a man. It's nothing to do with EdTech. Well, it is kind of. It's to do with technology. And is it to do with the future education? Maybe not. I got a new barbecue. Now, this barbecue is not any old barbecue. It is a Traeger grill. And it's pellet driven. It's Wi-Fi enabled, so I can turn it on from my phone when I'm on my way home. It's class. It's class. So I'm looking forward to testing that out.
Wi-Fi enabled barbecue. That is tech, in fairness. But wow.
Yeah. It's the way forward. It's the way forward. You want to have smart stuff anyway, don't we? Yes.
How does it do that with coals? Or is it a gas one? I'm guessing.
It's a pellet one. So it's plugged in, but it's a pellet. Pellet works. Yeah. So. That's how it works. So that's what it is.
Can anybody remember linking into this? When I first started and delved into EdTech, there was a gentleman called Ben Forte. I don't know if anyone remembers Ben. I'm sure they do. Of course we remember Ben. But Ben was massively into Google, massively into EdTech and all this stuff. I can't remember his base, but Ben also had a massive passion for barbecues, and now runs a massive barbecue brand in the States. Right. So yeah, he made a decision which where he went. So there is this tangible link between barbecues and their tech, of course.
Tenuous, then... very, very tenuous, not tangible, very tenuous. Yeah. Well, it's great to be on another podcast today, and we are always pleased when authors send us books and say we'd love to have a discussion about it, and that's no different today. We are pleased to be joined by an author and a founder of a company working in this education technology space. So let's bring him in. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very, very well. We are glad to be on another episode of the Edge of Futurist podcast and grateful that you joined us, sent us a copy of your book, and I've been patient enough to wait for us. I say us, maybe not a plural. Wait for this book to be read. I won't say who by. He's not even listening. He doesn't even know if I'm talking about him.
I'm just ignoring you because I thought he was going to be absolutely hammering me.
I was a little bit. So tell us a little bit about you. Introduce yourself. Tell us a bit about the work that you've been doing.
Yeah. So I work at all kinds of intersections of education and technology, and I've gotten a chance to do that for the last 15 years. I've done everything from build online tutoring solutions to helping institutions transition during the COVID-19 pandemic. But a lot of my work right now is on AI. So we're doing everything from providing professional development workshops to schools to doing some of the thought leadership on this, thinking about what the next step is for education, and also kind of trying to figure out what are the coolest things we can build with the technology that's coming out. So I'm trying to keep ourselves busy with all aspects of this.
Yeah. So you are the CEO of a founder of a tech company, EdTech company, Pedagogy Cloud. Is that right? That's the organization. And then more broadly, have been looking, or more recently, have been looking at this world of AI. Give us a little bit of background to you, like where you came from, how you got into this, kind of like your passion that sits with that.
Yeah. So my first like time building an education venture was as a high school student. I kind of worked on, we were trying to figure out a way to bring tutoring to a like impoverished area near us. And, you know, back in like, 2009, we were trying to figure out what the easiest way to do that while scaling it was. And with a bunch of high school students who couldn't drive yet, we decided that like some sort of online system was the way to do it. And so that's when I first learned my development skills. So like I'm not a professionally trained computer scientist. All of my like tech skills were kind of learned as needed for projects. And then my educational path kind of took me through all sorts of different aspects of education. My bachelor's was in philosophy. So we did a lot of thinking about political philosophy at that point, educational justice. And then I did a master's in education policy and management. So a lot of my professional, like traditional educational path has been thinking about education at the big level, and then trying to figure out how to bring that as close to possible to reality using the technology skills that exist today. So as we talk, you'll kind of see some background of like philosophy come out. You'll see some of the, like, I did a lot of Sanskrit and Latin in college. And so you'll see some of the, like, the linguist nerd come out of me as well. And so we'll kind of have some fun conversations.
Just before Steve comes in, this feels like an interesting move. I didn't know anybody else did Latin to a high level other than me. Like, so I did Latin to A level and talk about it regularly. And interestingly, I usually say, the only thing I remember is Amor, Masamata, Marmus, Amata, Samant, and Calculus, Sparta. Like, and think to myself, like, what did I learn that for? So I usually use it in a negative context and say Latin was, I loved it at the time, but do I actually do anything with it? And so, yeah, interesting that you've got into that linguistic space. And also interesting that you study philosophy. I used to teach religious studies and philosophy of religion. So intrigued. Steve, you might want to turn off at this point. We'll just have a conversation. Not that you can't get involved, but we might just talk a little bit about Kant. We might talk some Locke and some Mill and some cool stuff like that. Kierkegaard. Let's see where we go. No, I'm joking. I don't think anybody will listen to the podcast ever again.
What were you saying? I just heard you can. And you can, Ben. Do you know what I said?
Cats. So interestingly, about philosophy, for the last few months we've been talking about Schrodinger's cat, Steve's like, he keeps mentioning a cat. I don't understand what he's talking about. The cat being in a box or something. Why are we putting cats in boxes? What we've been talking about is that we don't just record a podcast and it goes out that same day or that same week. We've been doing it in future. So when we're talking, are we talking in the future? Are we talking in the past? Where are we? Are we really here? Are we not? So yeah. So, sorry. Anyway, a little detour. Steve?
Yeah, I think my take on that snippet was, you said, oh, well, I've not studied it. I've studied this and I've studied this. So my bit is self-taught, or I've done it related to projects. And I think that's, I'm not trying to go away from anybody that's done a degree or a master's or a PhD in a particular subject. It's not what I'm saying. But ultimately, I think learning it into context and applying it to a project is often a great way to learn something, and because you're also, you find a passion and something you want to stay on. I know some people who followed engineering pathways for 5 years and then found their information outdated by the time that they've left that 5-year course, often are frustrated by it because they thought that they were going into a career where it's not. You've kind of got a bit of a career that's a little related to a project, and then you've applied it to a bit of a slasher kind of side hustle idea, which I absolutely love. So when you were kind of learning those bits of bits that you applied, so in terms of, you know, like the development side of it or anything else, what were the key bits that you felt, why would I not taught this? Why did I have to kind of self-learn it, I guess, it would be the bit. And what drove you to then constantly evolve in terms of being a lifelong learner?
Yeah, oh, that's a good question. So I think a part of it was a good chunk of the things that I ended up self-teaching were things that, like, I think were all the practical skill sets. And so my favorite, like, memory of starting the first organization was, like, being a 10th grader and filling out the taxes for the organization. And we had, like, a 50-page form we had to fill out. And I didn't have the resources at that time as a 10th grader to like hire a CPA. And so I got to spend lots of time on the internet figuring out how to file like nonprofit taxes. But also like a lot of the development skills, computer science was something that was offered as one class in our school at that time. This is like well before, I mean, even now, I don't even have any more classes were offered in a lot of the public schools in the US. But there was not an option for me to take a computer science class at that point at all. So in order to like build the kinds of things that I think were the coolest things to build, I kind of just had to like figure out practical ways to learn the knowledge. There were lots of bookstores with lots of nice books that kind of broke this down into very practical, simple steps. And actually, that's one of my favorite ways to still learn new computer science things. So even like when I'm learning something new in computer science and I don't like actually particularly have the use for it, I still just like to come up with some sort of project. And that to me feels like the easiest way to stay motivated. Like when I'm building something, I feel like I actually want to learn the material. I kind of feel like there's some end goal in sight. And so I can go through the trudge of like, okay, this is like nowhere close to being something finished yet, but there's some insight that I want to make happen. So what do I need to learn to get there? And you know, there's really good research on why that works for students in formal settings too. And so we definitely want to think about what that might mean for how we teach these things in a formal way and not just like when I'm self-teaching myself some of these things. But the other part of this was like, I kind of wanted to spend a lot of time talking to people about interesting things. And to me, like thinking about the language, the art, the religion, the philosophy was where like I felt like the best use of my time when I was in a classroom with other people. It's one thing to like teach yourself like coding skills on your own, but try to like sit in a room by yourself and talk about like Schrodinger's cat and it becomes way weirder. And so it was nice to use my time like while I was in a formal education setting to kind of be doing some of those things, having some fun conversations that I think would have been much different on my own.
So it's contextual learning. You've got into contextual learning. And then obviously part of what you are working on with the company that you're in and the work that you're doing currently has come out of a passion to utilize tech in a contextual way, but in a way that makes a difference, right? So talk to us a little bit about Pedagogy Cloud and how that's set up and the journey that that's gone through. And then we'll get into telling us a little bit of story around why the book came to be.
Yeah. So a lot of the work that I do right now in Pedagogy.cloud is actually built off of a lot of the work that I did for my own nonprofit. And so like as I kind of develop these tech skills, started thinking about how technology could be used to solve solutions for the projects that I was working on, I realized that other people also had problems they wanted to solve with technology. And so that's kind of where the company started out. We started building custom solutions for other educational organizations, everything from like online learning management systems, courses. One of my favorite projects is a mastery learning-based system where the system kind of like feeds the student continuous practice questions until they kind of master the topic and then it gives them the next topic. We've had really good results with that. Universities across the U.S. are using it. But it's a great example of how, like, if we embrace technology, we can really solve some of the problems in education that, like, we all agree that students should get rid of practice until they master a topic. But practically in a classroom, like providing a student like hundreds of exercises until they master a particular topic is just not feasible. But technology can make that happen. So they can go home, they can do like XYZ number of exercises until they've mastered a topic and then kind of move on to the next step, which would be the ultimate goal in education, would be that everybody's achieving mastery and not just like, oh, like what have you learned by March 15th? And if not, like you've passed or failed and that's it. So you know, that's where you start to see like the potential for technology to actually kind of like get us where we want to be, but as humans alone, we can't really get our students there. And then a lot of our work kind of shifted during the pandemic to helping all kinds of organizations adapt to the online space. And so we did everything from work with like small school districts to large public school districts to help them kind of figure out what it meant to transition some of their school activities online. We did everything from host like international debate tournaments, model UN conferences, built up the summer camps online for students and some folks, like some cool features for like an online banking account and things like that to kind of mimic the kinds of things we're doing in person. So and some of those things folks have decided to keep using in person now. So we still have clients that use some of the work we did then and kind of have innovated to figure out, oh, like these kinds of things that we figured out where students enjoy doing for like the online version of the camp, we get to kind of still do in person. Because it's just much more effective and efficient. So another good example of like how the tech kind of gave us an opportunity to rethink some of the things we were always doing and found that there were ways to like kind of get students more excited about things. Lately, we're kind of figuring out all different ways to figure out how we can have conversations about AI. with all sorts of educational institutions there as well. So some of our like educational institutions that are like nonprofits or universities building research solutions, we work with them to figure out how AI might actually make their solutions that they were already working on better. And so, for example, with that mastery learning plan, we're figuring out, oh, like, can AI generate some more exercises for us? Maybe even if it's right now stuff that humans would check first, could help us churn out even more so that we can ensure that students have enough practice exercises for the mastery learning solution. And then we're doing a lot of helping folks kind of figure out what honor policies need to look like in the age of AI for their schools. What does it mean to assign like homework now? Kind of figure out how, oh, like, what does it mean to for a teacher to try to use this to streamline some of their work? And I'm hoping we can have some of this conversation today is like the more important thing to me is what does this mean for what we teach our students and how we teach them longer term, right? So there's, of course, all these short-term implications that we have to navigate, but there's also like lots of things for us to think about in terms of what the five-year plan for education across the world is.
Yeah, and I think that's, I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago and it was the now, I think, is the people that are struggling with, which is absolutely fine, but it's also that ambition of, don't pitch it too high so they can't see it because they're a million miles away from it. But also setting the context of, but you have to have this vision because if you just focus on how can it improve this one thing that you're currently doing, how can it improve this, as those systems and those processes and all of that really needs to change and has needed to change for a long period of time. As that evolves or completely changes, you're going to be doing something and you're then going to go, oh, but I used AI to or technology to do this thing that seems like it's obsolete now. And it's like, because you focused on this key element of it that is the now rather than, you know, what the steps are to and a builder to get to that point. And that could be lesson planning, or I hear it all the time of, you know, cheating in the written variation of assessments, and I'm like, that's absolutely fantastic, but let's be honest, assessment had to change and has had to change for a long period of time. You focusing and saying, oh well, it'll allow students to cheat on an assessment, and I asked the question back to the audience. I said, who's really over the last 5 or 10 years written an assessment process to iron out and reduce that down and remove written assessments down to the norm that it should be rather than every single medium of assessment? And I think that's the challenge of just going through the mill all of the time helps people survive in education rather than thrive. And I think we just have to really start to think about how we're going to thrive and how we're helping learners thrive. But let's delve into the book a little bit. And you've talked about some of the why and your journey, but give us a bit of an overview in terms of, as the author of it, what's its position? And what's your intended impact of the book, I guess?
Yeah, I think you actually kind of answered that for me earlier when you talked about the now and the future, right? And so that's I think where like that's where the book came out of was I think I was at this place of like, oh, like this, a lot of things that I wanted to make happen became possible overnight. This actually shows that, like, right, like the AI was moving much faster than I thought it was moving when the technology initially became public in November of 2022. And so I was sitting there, like, really giddy, really excited, and trying to figure out, oh, like, what can we make happen now? What might be actually, like, possible in the next 2 to 3 years that wasn't possible before when I was making my, like, 5-year plans for products? And I was trying to, like, have conversations with folks about, like, oh, like, this is a great opportunity for us to rethink some things and some good opportunity for us to use these things in productive ways. And folks were just like, what are you talking about? This is a cheating tool. Like that was the universal response from educators was like, you are way too excited about something that is a really bad thing. And so the book was an opportunity to meet them at the now and say, okay, look, like I understand there are students are using it for cheating. Those are valid concerns. There are reasons why that makes your life really difficult in the middle of a school year. And that's also valid. But there's also really interesting ways that you can use this productively for yourself, for your students, and it can hopefully start having some of those conversations that we need to have about like, oh, like what are problems that we've always had in education? These are not brand new problems that are suddenly created overnight. I think you alluded to that already, right? Like these assessments aren't just ineffective now. We have good research that these assessments have always been effective. They haven't motivated students. They haven't tested every student equally. But, you know, we can talk all about like why traditional assessments are bad. Absent like the world of AI. And so this is just one other way for us to expose that. But that's true of a lot of other problems. Like there's massive equity problems in education that are getting exposed. There's massive problems with who exactly we're like making sure we target with our interventions. And all those kinds of things, AI has kind of made more obvious to us. And my hope with the book was, okay, like, look, we all agree these are problems. AI might offer some solutions. And if not, it's going to make the problems worse enough that we need to find some other solutions. And so hoping to plant some of those seeds with the book was the secondary goal as well.
So planting that seed around the now into the future, thinking around practical uses of it, but not but acknowledging that even the examples that you use, and I know that in the book, obviously, we've got copies of the book. Steve, show us your copy of the book. There we go. That's like that feels like it should be a promo picture. Yeah, so feel free to use that when the podcast comes out. Steve, yeah. you're on mute, Steve. The future of education.
Why is AI not helping me unmute? I don't know what's going on there. Yeah. What I was saying is I couldn't take a screenshot because I was holding the book at the same time. And also, I'm a man. I can't multitask. Which is often true. So yeah, go on, Ben.
But what I was saying is that obviously you've given some prompt examples that you've put into the that you know probably by the time it's printed they've got a shelf life, and the fact of the pace of change, and obviously Moore's law and all the stuff that goes with it, that everything's moving at a pace that we have got zero control over. It feels like everything's moving so fast. So I think it's really important that the book isn't intended to be this is how you use AI, and this is a one-stop shop. You're not trying to be that. You're trying to set up the conversations that need to be had, and the almost is the philosophy stuff, right? The kind of positioning, the way that you feel about something, and how you approach something, and that it's that kind of growth mindset, that ability to keep learning, that ability to realize that it's not done just because this product might be. You talk a lot about obviously ChatGPT in this because it's the most widely used one by most people as a model. But all of us will have had examples where ChatGPT hasn't played nice recently, and then we've gone on to Gemini and we've thought, oh, Gemini's doing really well, and then we've got onto Gemini and realized, well, we're in the UK, so we can't do anything with images in the UK at the moment. So, oh, that's annoying. So now we'll play back with ChatGPT again and use DALL-E, or we might go into Perplexity, or we might go into and so it just goes on and on and on and on. So it's not about the tool per se; it's about how we kind of position ourselves around that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, obviously, one of the other considerations was this was a professionally published book, and so the timeline for getting something out. Even like if we talk about a second edition, it's a massive lag. Like I can't, you know, it's not the same pace that like a self-published book will move at. And so one of the considerations that we have with the editor was the book needs to kind of be timeless enough to get us through another edition first. And so you'll notice that like even the prompts, they're not really like traditional ChatGPT prompts, right? They're like one-liners, because the goal with those prompts wasn't to like necessarily give a teacher something they can copy and paste and put into ChatGPT and be perfectly functioning. It was, oh, like here's 10 different ways you might think about using any of these tools, whether it be ChatGPT or Perplexity. And here's like ways for you to start that conversation. The preface kind of gives them an idea that like that might not be the only thing you should put in as your prompt, depending on what tool you're using. But it hopefully that kind of gets them to think, oh, I didn't even think about the fact that I could ask it to do something like this. And that's true regardless of what tool they use. And so the goal was definitely to kind of help them think through what the potential for the technology was, regardless of what the latest tool is when they pick up the book. Because you're right, like when the book was finished writing versus now, I think about like 6 new models in the mainstream have come out, let alone like any of the open source models or anything like that. But I think the book still has, I think I've so far, I feel like it's still met the burden of time and kept up with the technology. But that you know, the other thing is the gap between where folks are and where the technology is for folks who are using it like proficiently is still huge. And so brand new users of the technology will still need all this introductory work, even if there's the latest model with like 20 new features out there. Folks still need to kind of like build up to that space. And so we're still hoping to fill that need of helping folks kind of build up to the point where they can actually go in and research their own models and figure out the next steps and figure out which model works in their country and which model has the coolest new feature, which can do images and not do images and all that kind of stuff. But you definitely need some basic literacy in the AI space in order to do any of that as well.
Yeah, and a lot of it is around like in being literate is kind of double pronged word, in a sense that literate being literally being able to write prompts or write and manage that from a text based thing, but I think it's literate as in a level of understanding around how things are working, what things are to be taken on face value, what things you shouldn't take on face value, what things it can do, what things it can't do. Even phrases like prompts. You use the word prompts. A lot of people, unless you're in a tech space, we know what the word prompts mean, but doesn't always translate naturally into an education space or LLMs or whatever it is, hallucinations, like your bias. People have got to have be shown that, right? And I think we will definitely get into the ethical considerations, because I think that will tie itself into the conversation that you have around your not-for-profit that you're already doing. But I wonder where you are thinking the benefit of using AI is, because obviously we'll talk about the challenges and we'll talk about some of the limitations, but what happened November 2022 for most people who were in this, who were early adopters into this space, they were going, this is changing everything. Then when we hit that like trough of disillusionment where we were just like, it does this, but it doesn't quite do this. It doesn't quite unmute my microphone when I should be speaking, right? It doesn't quite do those things. It's not being intuitive. It's not thinking for me in the same way. Our friend Dan Fitzpatrick, I'll quote him here, and he says about AI, about outsource the doing, not the thinking. And actually that's what it's doing for us lot. But so maybe talk to us a little bit about where you think the benefit of AI is going to be in the future of education, or even in the now of education.
Yeah. I think the now and the future are still quite a bit apart. And I think it's a good thing. So I think in the now, there's definitely just teacher workload things that are beneficial, right? So there's a lot of work that teachers have to do outside of the classroom that I don't think anybody particularly feels super motivated to do. And so whether it be creating these practice exercises, whether it be creating lesson plans, working on those kinds of things, there is a benefit to a teacher not having to do all those things. Now, is that the most exciting thing for the future of education? Probably not. But is it practical for a real teacher on the ground who like has to come up with 5 lesson plans because they're teaching 5 different classes next day? Yeah, it makes a huge difference when you can kind of like offload even some percentage of your work, because you're right that it might not fully do 100% exactly what we want it to do all the time yet. But even getting it to that 80% and then kind of being able to do it the other 20% yourself makes a huge difference when you're scrambling to like figure out how to use your time the most effectively. I'm hoping that teachers are able. So that's like step one. It's like, how can I like offload the things that I already have to do and have it do it for me, which I think is exactly Dan's hinting at here. But the other step is also think about like what couldn't I do before that I might want to do that AI makes possible. I think those are the more exciting conversations that we're starting to have, which is, what kinds of assignments was I not able to assign before because it was too much work for me to prepare all the material for it or to come up with different rubrics for every single different student? And what kinds of things does that AI make possible that now I can implement those things? And so when we talk to teachers who are now excited about, oh, maybe I can solve both the cheating problem and I can actually like do this like project-based learning activity that I've always wanted to do, but that activity required me to come up with like 10 different like scenarios for each student. And that kind of work I didn't have time to do for one particular assessment, right? So though that's where I'm hoping that we can start thinking, oh, wow, like now we can do really complicated things that we've wanted to do that we know actually works well for our students, engages them more in the activities, helps them learn the material better, but wasn't feasible for any one teacher to do for any one class period. And then long term, I'm hoping we can start to see some cooler tools that come out that kind of really push the boundaries here. And so I think like getting content to be customized to each student is definitely something that I'm hoping that we see more of, especially as the hallucination rates go down, as we can start trusting some of these systems more and don't need a human. Like right now, I would still feel more comfortable if a teacher was checking these materials before they came out. So is it better if a teacher has like 100 exercises to check rather than 100 exercises to make? Absolutely. That is light years ahead of where they were 2 years ago. It makes their life much easier. But ideally, like in a few years, we have systems where the systems are catered to a particular student's interest. And so these are some of the conversations that we've been having. Is like, if you're teaching grammar to a group of like, you know, young students, could you print out exercises for each student based on things that they're interested in? And so the grammar exercises for somebody interested in sports are all sports related examples, and somebody interested in music has all music related examples. And so they're also learning grammar and they're learning where the commas go. But the examples and the sentences are all things that like kind of are interesting to them rather than just like a random Bob and Sally are like at the supermarket kind of sentence. And those things might also help our engagement rates in the short term.
Yeah, and I know we're thinking about that engagement and only thinking about potentially the now, I guess. But that context of some of the benefits that we kind of lost during COVID from asynchronous learning, where it was like face-to-face, connectivity, everything's better back in the classroom. I understand, you know, that building of human connection is something that drives us, and humans seek it and thrive from it. But ultimately, the things that we're missing is we had an opportunity to, through asynchronous learning and through AI, to, like you say, really personalize our experience for the learner. That ultimately, as a teacher, you create as much as you can within the time frames. Teaching globally is a time poor profession. There isn't enough time in the day to create everything, and ultimately that stems and stimulates a spillover in terms of what we do on an evening and a weekend. But ultimately, it gives the ownership and the power back to those learners to then say, this information has been given in this context to me. I want to receive it in this way, so they can then start to be empowered to then think, okay, what does that look like in my context in terms of this bit of knowledge? Can you create, I want to watch a video on it. I don't think a video exists. So based on this text prompt, can you create a short video for me? Or can you do it? And I saw Dan do this actually a couple of weeks. Could you sing this in a song to me in the style of Johnny Cash and Barbie Girl and all of those kind of things that we'll find all over YouTube? But ultimately, it's that bringing the fun element, but also bringing the learner to where they want to be. And I think my, and we're talking in the 90s here when I was going through my learning experience, but it was one methodology, and I'm not saying all learning is like this. The teacher created it. It was given to you when we were empty vessels ready for filling. And literally, I didn't want to learn that way. And I think this empowers students to then give them their autonomy to say, I want to learn it in this way. And also, that video or that bit of context that's been given, it's an hour. I don't have an hour right now because I want to go out and play my bike. So can you just break that down into four chunks for me in the best way possible? I'll learn it now, go out on my bike, come back in, after tea, 15 minutes, and then it starts to break it down and pause it. And all of those bits, I don't think that's new, but this really helps the students and the learning focus on their learning and how they want to learn it, rather than actually how the teacher wants to drive the learning experience for them. Have you seen in the US that there is AI has started to drive that change forward, or do you still see that it's a struggle to try and help to get the understanding of just basics of teacher training for on AI tools as they develop and evolve?
Yeah, I think there's a split definitely between the K-12 and the higher ed space in terms of the comfort level with something like that as well. So I think the K-12 level is still figuring out, like, A, how do we deal with AI detection and plagiarism? And I think that's because there's just like a bunch of assignments that became obsolete overnight, as the folks are still dealing with the shock of that, I think, about 2 years later. And reasonably so, when everything you've done for the last like 2 decades suddenly becomes obsolete, is kind of shocking. But then I think that the other problem is folks are still pretty wary about like bringing technology directly to students officially through the school system. And I think that's legitimate. I think it's valid. And I think we want to make sure that like whatever technologies they are bringing in front, like either they're doing it as an AI literacy moment and like, oh, we're going to play with this tool, but it's not exactly supposed to replace your other instruction yet, because we're not sure it's always going to be accurate. And that's how we've seen some of these tools be brought in. It's like, oh, like maybe you can go use ChatGPT to do something for your assignment, but like always remember you fact check everything because they can hallucinate. And that those kind of conversations are important for the students because they're going to be using these tools anyways. And so that's a great opportunity for them to start playing around with it. The higher ed space, we've been seeing a lot more folks kind of figure out how they can use this in productive ways on their own. It's the kinds of things you were talking about, Steve, are exactly the kinds of things I think some college students are trying, where they're able to put in this paper they have to read and kind of have it break it down into like language that's not super academic and kind of inaccessible to them, or ask them come up with like 10 questions for them to review the paper, even though they're not actually like, you know, they're studying for a Socratic dialogue the next day in their classroom, and they kind of just want to like have the ChatGPT or Claude or whatever, come up with a bunch of questions for them to kind of prep for the Socratic dialogue. And so this is where I'm hoping that we'll start to see, I think we'll see some of the individual student usage of like, oh, how can I use this most effectively to learn this material? Probably more at the higher ed level still, because those are the students who will have access to it. Those are the students who will be encouraged to use it. And then there are the students who will also have to do a lot of work outside of the classroom on their own before they show up to classroom to demonstrate knowledge. And so, now, I'm hoping we can start seeing some examples of what might be effective at a younger level from that. And so there might be lessons we can learn from how assessments are redone in the college setting, or how assessments are, have always been done in the college setting, where a lot of work happened independently outside of the classroom. Students kind of figure out how best they'll learn. They're responsible for it, and you know, maybe there should be more guidance on how they can do that. But at the end of the day, like, a student was responsible for showing up for the exam, prepared whatever way they can. And we kind of handhold a lot more at the K-12 level, and for a good reason, but maybe there's room for us to start giving some more options for that space. And some of the examples that you cited about, oh, like, maybe if you don't really want to like read this paragraph from your textbook today, you can feed it into the system and it'll create a video for you, or it'll create like a gamified version for you. Or maybe it'll create a VR AR experience for you, right? Like, those are all kinds of things that aren't too far off. Maybe they're not easily accessible right like now today, but those aren't like, you know, decades away.
No, they're definitely not decades away. And obviously, as we're recording this, Sora have just released their second version of the text-to-video, which are just insane, right? And I know that we don't have that access to that. Every person's got access to that universally. But what that means is relatively significant. And I know, as interestingly, I had an Audible subscription for a long time. I listened to podcasts. Crazy amount of podcasts. I've got 4 podcasts that I listen to every episode that ever comes out. I listen to them. So probably I listen to 4 or 5 podcasts a week. But I read a lot. But I tried Audible and I haven't been able to get it to land for me, right? So it sounds really silly, but being able to listen to a podcast for 3 hours is fine. But listening to a audiobook for that same length of time, or split up over time, I don't feel like it goes in. But a book goes in if I read it, a physical one. I've tried Kindle, can't do it. So it's interesting knowing that I definitely learn better by a physical book than I would do from an Audible book. But I also know that I learn really well from watching something. But I can't just watch, right? I have a little toy that I'm always messing around with because of other thing. And interestingly, that space makes me acknowledge that the one size fits all model is obviously we say on the podcast quite a lot, one size fits all actually means one size fits none, because nobody is the general rule. There's always outliers, there's always a curve. So my whole conversation about that personalization is not just about like we've got to create the brand new thing for every young person, which is not necessarily what personalization means from an AI perspective. Personalization is they are going to need to learn X to be able to move to Y, to be able to move into their next level of learning. And yes, there should be some autonomy and choice into what they learn, but realistically, there's lots of learning science that's gone on for a long time that says these are foundational things that you are going to need to be able to understand, to be able to do these other bits. Not everything is foundational or constructivist at all. But what it will do from personalization is about how you access that medium and what medium you use for that, and then how you digest it. So like Steve saying there, break it up into 4 chunks for me is probably better for some people, whereas others of us, like, give me an hour and I'll do an hour. And it's like, and that's a better way to work, right? It's that personalization that works on that level.
Yeah. And there's something that you both kind of hinted at that I don't think we've like explicitly said, which is that these also show that like this idea that like tech is that one size fits all solution might also not be true. And as someone who's in ed tech and like building AI solutions, that maybe like I'm shooting myself in the foot a little bit, but the reality is that like the tech doesn't always meet every student's needs perfectly, right? And so when you're talking about like students during the pandemic who are like watching live classes, or taking async classes, who are not actually like engaging and they're like, you know, not showing up to the Zoom classes, and they might have always been like a motivated student in person when they had like their peers around them, they had their teacher around them. That should say something about like the fact that everything isn't just a one-to-one translation. So how can I make this into a tech solution? There's some of the opportunity here is how can we actually bring more time into the classroom where it's a more human classroom and a less structured classroom where we're trying to like figure out how to pass the standardized test. Hopefully we can ask some questions that make our classrooms like less tech and more solution based. And so we're not all sitting on our computers like churning away at practice questions for the standardized test. because we now have newer opportunities to do some of the learning. And then even the example of like, oh, like the Kindle book not being equivalent to the physical book, right? Like the, in a tech person's head, those are the same. It's like, why is it not this, right? Like, why does it not work for you? It's the exact same content delivered in a more seamless and effective way. And that's the narrative I think we're getting from some AI folks. It's like, oh, like this is the same thing, but only better, right? Like there's no, why are you not like embracing this? Because there's no disadvantages. But at the end of the day, I think the physical has its own power that I don't think the tech will ever be able to fully replace. And so that's, I think, as we think about what the future of education holds and what we're going to make available to our teachers and what we're going to push on our students, I think remembering that, like, hopefully some of the changes we make actually allow us to move away from like always being on our screens in a classroom or like pushing towards being on a screen towards in a classroom. Hopefully we can have some of those conversations as well.
Agreed. I think it leads us really nicely into that space, because we've talked about how tech isn't a panacea always. It's not the right thing to use. And there's an increasing movement, isn't there, in not just in the US, but across the world around, is our mental health crisis perhaps related to our full immersion in tech? Is the fact that we have a huge lack of connection to do with the fact that we feel like our connection requests on LinkedIn or on Twitter or whatever else are real things when they're not real people, and you've never met them? I'm not saying they're wrong, but ultimately there's a conversation there about that tech isn't always the answer, right? And interestingly, one of the things in the book that you talk about is the ethical considerations around using AI. So I think it moves us nicely into that space around that, and I think it'll navigate itself naturally into your not-for-profit that you've alluded to a couple of times. Talk to us a little bit about that, because I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued because, and the reason why I'm intrigued is because obviously my own background in that space, but also we want to make sure that the AI tools don't exacerbate the gaps or the challenges or the ethical problems that we've had already, a lack of equity. The fact that the rich have more stuff, the more access than the not rich, the people with different abilities are going to be, or disabilities as they may have been previously called, are going to have a different experience. So could you speak at that maybe?
So I think this is where, like, I think a lot of folks are really excited about the technology. They're like, oh, we can solve some of the achievement gaps. We can give every student a personalized tutor, right? Like that kind of narrative is definitely out there. And this is one where I'm just like, okay, we have to be really careful if that's the outcome we want. Because I think in almost every scenario that I see, out of like every 100 scenarios, 99 of these make the problem worse. And so we have to get everything really right in order for us to actually solve some of these problems. And I think you already hinted at some of them, right? So I talked a little bit about the digital divide. And we saw this a lot when we were working with institutions for the pandemic, which is that like not every student had access to a device. Not every student even had the like quality of broadband necessary to get on a Zoom call. And they didn't even have the tech literacy to make use of these tools, even if they had both of those things. And so this is not just about, like, do I have AI literacy or not, but like, how fast do I type on a keyboard? Have I taken a typing class in my classroom? Like, how quickly can I read on screen? How quickly do I read in general, right? Like, there are basic skills that you still need that make these tools either really useful or completely like useless to you. And those gaps predate AI, right? We have a literacy gap, we have AI like a tech gap, we have like digital divide, and all of those problems kind of need to be solved before we can say, oh, this is going to be the magical pill that like solves everything. Even then, I'm still wary about like where this is meeting us, right? So part of the conversations that we're also starting to see is folks are like, oh, like now that AI can do these things, we need to push our students to do the next like 10 level things, right? So like, oh, if AI can do all this kind of thinking and synthesizing, maybe all our students need to be doing is this really high level critical thinking. And that's true. We should be pushing our students to do more higher order critical thinking, because that's the reality is that like AI will offload some of our like lower level cognitive tasks. But that's not how we can't approach education that way, right? Like we still have students who can't do that lower level, the lower level thinking before they can do the higher level thinking. And so we kind of need to make sure that we're not suddenly skipping the stages of like getting them through all those levels of cognitive development before we start like embracing this higher level critical thinking. Because what's going to happen is those students are going to be able to use AI to do that lower level critical thinking for them, make their way through a school system, and then get out in the real world and not actually be able to build on that because they never build those lower level critical thinking skills. So that's you know, that's definitely a worry, is that like if we jump the gun too easily to like, oh, how can we get our students to be better than AI? We kind of need them to at least get somewhere before they can take advantage of that. The other, and this is where like building off the last conversation, like we also want to think about when we decide to use these tools, like tech tools versus human interventions, right? So if we find ourselves saying, oh, we're going to like provide the most impoverished neighborhoods with like personalized tutors through AI, but our like more affluent neighborhoods are still using human tutors, that should clue us into like the fact that there's probably some value to the human tutors or those AI tutors. And those AI tutors are being used as like a short-term, oh, we're doing something for this population narrative and not actually solving the real problems, right? So of course, it's nice to be able to say everybody has an AI, like, and everybody has a tutor in their pocket. But if some of those people still aren't getting like high quality human tutors that are keeping them accountable, that are helping their social emotional development, and then we have like a subset of students who are now like, oh, we gave them a tutor, but it's quality, right? Like, we really want to have those kinds of conversations as well. And that's my other worry, is that like even for accessibility concerns, like, oh, like if a school district is struggling with accessibility, providing EL support, providing ADHD support, whatever it might look like in the particular school district, if suddenly we're reducing human interventions and increasing the tech interventions, and the tech interventions aren't exactly what the students fully need, but they kind of allow someone to check off and say, oh, like we did this for every single student in our district. That's what I'm worried about. It's like, we need to make sure that the solutions are actually effective, actually meeting the students' exact needs. And they're not also just creating a further gap between like, okay, like now that this is an easier solution for this population, we can focus our human effort on like the more affluent neighborhoods or like mainstream students.
Yeah, and I think, probably in many professions, but the teaching profession, the gap of how many teachers we actually need compared to where we currently are and how that will be increased over the next 5 to 10 years. Maybe this will fill some of the gaps, managed, so a human being always the touch point, but managing some of the AI and utilizing some of the AI tools to help increase and expand the reach to make sure that some of those education systems that really are still in their infancy across the world, where it's very raw and it's very not as developed. But ultimately, I think at the same point as well, we have to have a realization of why we have a massive number of educators leaving the system. Right. Is it the fact that most careers and more other professions will allow you to have a bit of a hybrid, so you can mix between both and you can be a bit of a part-time teacher and you can do this and you can do, but ultimately teaching is a profession where if you work 2 days, you're not really working 2 days. You're working well beyond that. It's not something where you can be this and this and this. It's a real challenge for anybody. It's a part-time teacher listening. I'd be interested to hear your stories and some of the ways that you've been led. Because that's a real challenge, isn't it? And maybe AI will help us revolutionize the way that we teach, the way that we support learning, the way that we get learners to learn and take a bit more autonomy with some attributes. Because right now, what is the reason why educators are leaving? And also, going back to that feeling of the void and the gap, even if we say, right, we need this amount of teachers and we need 40 million teachers, it's going to take years to train them and prepare them for high quality teachers. So there is a gap there. And I've seen this in other professions like radiography, where they're using AI, and it's different, don't get me wrong, Joe. They're using AI to analyze x-rays because they have a shortage and a 5-year development plan for radiographers to then say, and that an AI is starting to identify probably 99% accuracy in terms of those x-rays, where then the human doctors can come in and just check off that work has been done on used number, and the human doctor is then coming in and saying, I agree, and it's a 5-minute task rather than a half an hour task for each one, and linking into the NHS in the UK, a lot of processes have caused lots of times delays. If you visit A&E, and I don't know what it's like in the US, if you visit accident and emergency, you'll be there a while. So how can AI be utilised to speed up some of those processes? And I think that's where I see it. I think transition to a new way of teaching and a new way of learning. I think filling the gaps, but also creating something very, very different. The exciting bit is we're still going into buildings to sit there and watch a video or listen to somebody speak for a long period of time and have been for decades and centuries. How can we change that so ultimately learning doesn't become an institution? It's actually about a process. And yes, the human element is in that space, but that bit is around connectivity and doing something different. But my fear, like with anything, is COVID gave us a real opportunity. We had a real differentiation where we had to do things very, very differently for a period of time. But we quickly fell back globally in many contexts to just the way that we were because people want to remain in that status quo. So how do you feel about that in terms of your journey and the work that you've done around the book and your ambition of where you see it going, I guess? Big questions, but where do you see
it? Lots of big questions. But I think just like starting with the teacher burnout, like shortage crisis, I think thinking about like, and this is where I think conversations that I would have with like a group of teachers versus the conversation we're having today that's high level are very different. Because if I'm in a room of teachers, I am helping them see, oh, like this might actually make your life easier in this way or that way. Here's how you can use it to do some of the things that you're doing. But at the larger level, we need to still like have the conversations that this isn't like suddenly making the teacher's life so easy that we don't need as many teachers, right? Like that my worry is that like the narrative around like, oh, this is going to solve the teacher burnout crisis means that policymakers aren't having conversations about, oh, like what other things do we need to change besides give them an AI tool that will prevent the mass exodus of teachers from the teaching profession, right? Like that is not going to solve our problem. Like the problem isn't that every teacher needs ChatGPT in their pocket and suddenly we're going to have like an abundance of teachers across the world. There's massive other problems that we need to solve in order to actually make this sustainable as a career. And when we have more and more of the conversations about like, oh, the AI tutor can do this, the AI thing can do this, I'm worried that policymakers are going to take those opportunities to think that that problem doesn't exist anymore because they have AI to fill that need. And so we definitely, I think, the exact kind of conversation that you're having right now, that like, this is, at the end of the day, this is going to be about like, how can we get more humans in front of more students in more human-like environments without the like, let's sit here and watch a video together. A teacher who is burnt out is more likely to have to like sit there and watch a video with their whole classroom. But if we can solve some of these other problems, we might actually give them an opportunity to like sit there and have a more dynamic classroom activity. And that I hope the AI can get us to. But at the end of the day, we still need that teacher in a small classroom with very few, right? Like it can't be a classroom of 100 students, which I think, again, like I think some folks with dollar signs in front of their like decision-making apparatus are thinking these might be some of the benefits long-term. But I think the reality is that will do a disservice to our students. Steve, you're going to have to ask me there were multiple different things you brought up. I want to make sure that I hit some.
You did. I think it's just the whole thing of why the different relationships in terms of what it will create, where it will take us, I guess. So I suppose the bit, and we go on to the quick fire questions as we come towards the end. But my bit is, out of all of these tech things that you've come across, and I don't think AI is just a tool. I think AI is a real differentiator because it's not just one thing that does one thing, and there are different mediums and different examples within it, but I'd be interested whether that's a short thing or a long answer in regards to why do you think AI now will help really transition us to a different future in education rather than one that we were currently on the path to. And I know it's not since November 2022, it's been a long journey before that, but why do you think the eyes have been opened and the genie's out of the bottle on this one?
Yeah, I think this is a case of like, I don't think we're going to be given much of a choice. And so I think this is, I think the point that I make in the book a little bit is that like, we have longstanding problems in education, these have kind of made them much more apparent without a lot of like leeway for us to like kind of ease our way into it, right? So it's in some ways, it's very similar to the pandemic in that like it was an overnight kind of shift in the external world that kind of dramatically changed what education needed to look like. Except it's much worse because things are still moving, right? Like the pandemic, it plateaued at some point. Like we were all home with our computers and like we kind of had like 2 years or 3 years, whatever it was across the world, to kind of just like be dealing with a stagnant change in education. This has like been a massive interruption, and that's continuously creating new interruptions. And so I don't think we're going to be given much of a choice to have to rethink the future, because I think our students will ask for it. I think the career world is going to like look very different for folks. And so I think we're going to start to see that, like, whatever, even if we can get through another school year doing everything we've been always doing, that's going to start to become really obsolete really quickly. But like at the same time, my hope for this isn't like my goal, or like I guess my vision isn't that like the AI is going to massively infiltrate our classrooms and suddenly like we're all in there with our like AR VR headsets like learning. I think that what this will allow us to do is to like, ask those deeper questions about like how exactly we want to structure like human learning all across the world. What kinds of things do we want to teach? How do we want to teach in a way that makes sure that every student is kind of learning what they need to learn, that they need in order to live their most fulfilling life? And I'm hoping that like helps kind of move some of the ownership away from like, let's not worry about like this one like static standardized test for the school year, but let's figure out like what are your interests in this topic area? How can I help you as an educator get to that place? And I think honestly, that might also help solve some of the teacher burnout, right? Like, part of the reason why teachers hate teaching is because they're not teaching in a way that they enjoy. And I think they would enjoy it a lot more if we didn't have to like do a very robotic, like systematic, like, you know, let's build these vessels type of teaching. I think they'd enjoy it much more if it's this relationship building and kind of helping each student kind of develop in their own way and learn their pursue their intellectual pursuits. And so I'm hoping that's the future of education because of AI. So I hope it like exposes all these pain points in a way that we just have to solve problems that we've all been ignoring for a long time.
Yeah, for sure, and hopefully that's the goal, right? That's what we're all trying to build towards, what we're all trying to teach towards, and all the training and workshops and keynotes and PD courses and books and all the things that are out there is that, not thinking that it's going to solve all problems, but if it can push the needle in the right direction, then we've got to do something. So really grateful for you for joining us. We always wrap up this season with three quick fire questions. So I'll start, and then Steve will do one. And then we've got three quick fire questions for you. So here we go. So the first one is future of exams, online, traditional, or scrapped?
I am hoping scrapped.
Key skill needed for students in 2040?
Emotional intelligence.
Education in 50 years. What's your vision for it?
Lots of humans together in a classroom with no screens.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you. Insightful. And we really are grateful that you've joined us on the podcast, Britton. If anybody hasn't already signed up and got AI and the future of education, teaching in the age of artificial intelligence, please jump over to anywhere you can get books and you'll be able to pick that up. You'll also be able to check out Britton's work at pedagoge.ai. That's in the show notes. And we're very, very grateful for you joining us. A big reminder for those people, if you are listening before the 4th of July, to get your tickets for the Edufuturist Uprising. It's our time to bring together the community, to celebrate our community around the podcast and all the things that we are, people that are trying to push that future of education, as well as celebrate those people with the Edufuturist Awards. Yeah, I think this is year five, Steve, of us doing these Edufuturist Awards, which is pretty cool. So we're very much...
11th of July. 11th of July.
What did I say?
4th.
Did I say 4th? It's 11th of July. Yeah. Don't listen to me. Don't come on 4th. It's not on. 11th of July.
You can come. You've been queuing outside. You know, like, it's like one of these big gigs where people are queuing to see, I don't know, Taylor Swift.
Something like that.
A week before it happens. But yeah, you can come on the 4th, but you'd be waiting for a week before we open the doors. But if you're that excited, that's absolutely fine. Let us know if you're there. We'll bring some food and some drink for you. But the 11th of July is exciting times. Lots of sponsors and everybody get involved now. So yeah, thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you, Brad.